the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, and today it's the public hearing on House Seal 5030, Department of Human Services. Community Human Services. That's a mouthful. And just a couple of housekeeping items. If there's anyone in the audience with a cell phone, please turn it off so that it doesn't interfere with the proceedings. And we also have with us today Rosie. Rosie, our pig, and Rosie is there to for two purposes, really. One is to catch us when we use the alphabet soup, and when we do so, we contribute to Rosie, and the proceeds of Rosie will go to help feed the people who are hungry in our society, the Oregon Food Bank. So with that, and we do have two from the Senate and one from the House today. Representative Bates.
Okay, I'll hold up the House.
And I think transcription is ready.
Sorry.
We're all ready.
Sorry,
Sheila, are you ready? We left off with Jerry last Thursday. Time is going by so fast.
Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee, just as a note, when you finish this week's public hearings, we will be halfway through the scheduled public hearings on the agency budgets.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Burns, and I'm here to feed the hungry and finish up my Community Human Services presentation. I'm the acting Deputy for Community Human Services in the department. I thought I'd finish up from where we were last Thursday, which was page 13, which was around the legislatively adopted staffing standards. I won't discuss vocational rehabilitation or senior people with disabilities, as those two program areas will be talking with you shortly, but I think maybe the most important thing that I could tell you about is that in terms of staffing, that one of our priorities over the next biennium is really to review and refine the internal processes that the department uses regarding caseload staffing in the field. And let me tell you a little about why we need to do that. The caseload standards that you see here in front of you were created and adjusted and refined incrementally over a number of years, and there were a number of variables that influenced those standards. I thought I'd just tell you at least about some of the more prominent ones. First and foremost is the establishing some sense of the amount of work that's required to actually correctly and properly serve each case. Secondly is having a sense about how much money is available to fund positions that are needed to do the work. Third is looking at the changes that are made by the federal government, by the legislature, and by our program experts in central office on policy, process, form, services, and timelines. Fourth is federal, state, and local audits of performance that can influence the number of staff that we need. Fifth is national and local studies and evaluations of best practices. And then lastly is that over time we simply find that the characteristics of the caseload begin to change and that the staffing needs to be adjusted to respond to that. So overall, I think when you look at staffing standards, there is some balance between kind of the best sort of scientific and research information that we've got and the reality of the resources that are available. Now, I'd say sort of in spite of all of this that at least in child welfare, that the Department of Human Services is really pretty close to the recommended national standards. Now, once the caseload standards are set, positions are created and they're allocated to the field. In child welfare, there is not a lot of flexibility about the use of positions. If a position was allocated for protective services, you can pretty much count on that being used for protective services in the local office. In the self-sufficiency public welfare programs, there is actually a lot of flexibility, and it's necessary to have that. One of the primary reasons is that in self-sufficiency programs, clients come into the offices and apply for a number of programs simultaneously, so caseloads tend to fluctuate fairly dramatically month over month in different local offices and across the state. If you look at the caseload standard here, on the left-hand side for self-sufficiency under TANF, which I might add stands for Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, it indicates that the standard is 1 to 90. What's not reflected in this is that that same worker will also handle the medical eligibility, the food stamp eligibility, and jobs program services for some or all of the cases that they are serving in that 1 to 90. In a rural area, that same worker will not only carry all of those programs, but will also probably cover food stamp applications for people who aren't applying for temporary assistance to needy families, as well as people who come in to apply for the employment-related daycare program. Probably the most dramatic example that we've got of the need for flexibility on the use of staff in the self-sufficiency area is the food stamp caseload. That over the first 18 months of this biennium, the food stamp caseload in Oregon has gone up by about 2,300 cases per month. Looking at the standards that are here, that means that each and every month we should add 10 caseworkers, 5 clerical positions, and 1 manager. We obviously have not been able to do that. So what it means is that local offices need to have the flexibility to respond, flexibility and the creativity to respond to needy Oregonians that are coming into our offices.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bate.
Sir, just so I can understand clearly what you're saying to us here, as an example, under Human Services Specialist 2/Case Manager, HP CHIP 1 to 260, any one of those 260 that came to that caseworker would also from that caseworker have access to all the services listed below that line. Am I understanding that correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, in this case, the 1 to 260 refers to staff who are in the central processing unit in Salem at our Parkway building that really do just handle Oregon Health Plan services. When you move to the case manager, where it says TANF assessment, emergency assistance, those are staff who really are going to be used more flexibly.
Well, Madam Chair, just so I understand, as I am a little confused about this and continue to be confused even after 3 years of looking at it, people trying to get an Oregon Health Plan, as an example, often call a phone number and get a caseworker over the phone and discuss what's going on. But they can also access it, I think, at the local level at times, too. And so there's an overlap there. And for the most part, what I see with patients needing OHP, they also are getting multiple other levels of care or help from the state. And I still hear about them seeing different caseworkers or different individuals to get those services. I'm still a little concerned that we have multiple caseworkers or workers with one single family, and they're getting this information from 3 or 4 different people when what I would like to see them get it from one, and maybe have an opportunity to be not only more efficient, but to cut back on what we need as far as caseworkers are concerned.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I couldn't agree more, and I think that's a part of what we need to continue looking at is how to be more and more efficient as we begin dealing with these families.
Madam Chair, one last question.
Yes.
Can we get an idea of how many unduplicated lives we're looking at as far as per caseworker? By that I mean, when you look at numbers of 1 to 80, 1 to 250, but if those numbers are being serviced by other caseworkers, then it makes those figures meaningless to me. And I'd like to see how many caseworkers we have and intake workers we have and how many people we service and just do the math and have an idea what that really looks like.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we can put that information together
for you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Chair, it might be helpful if you walk through what occurs if an individual contacts the agency and walks in the door is desirous of getting on the Oregon Health Plan. And then what happens if you have a person who, a family who is in, who has a child and that child's in foster care. I think what Dr. Bates and Representative Bates is getting at is how do they come together, and it was part of the discussion that we had when we created the reorganization, that in intake that you have a process set up so that, you know, you're not having duplication of effort no matter how the person enters into the system. So you may want to walk us through what happens locally in intake.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what I'd say to you is that that intake process, I think, varies across the state based on probably the size of the local area and the experience of the staff and then the local processes that they've established. In some areas of the state, particularly the smaller areas of the state, when a client comes in to apply for a program, they have pretty good processes in place to begin identifying whether there is services are already being offered by another program of the department. What I'd say is in the larger areas that process is really not in place, that it is it's an area that we continue to work on by using both our computer systems as well as sort of just local contacts to begin trying to identify those clients so that we can get to a collaborative plan or planning process.
Is there or are there plans to, and I know that some of it has been put in suspension, if you will, to where in central office that you are working to develop a plan to where, regardless if you're talking about an urban area or a rural area, that you have some commonalities in intake?
Our information systems folks have been looking at this pretty closely over the last year and a half. One of the areas that they've focused a lot of energy is how to begin identifying those clients. And they've actually got some areas where they've begun doing some pilot testing and are rolling it out. And one of those is called a client index, where when someone comes into the office, that the information can be entered into the computer system, and in fact it can begin searching the other computer systems of the department to identify what other services this client or client family has received. It is operational. I wouldn't say that it's running smoothly, but it is at least in process at this point, and we can begin doing that in some parts of the state.
Is it like White City? I mean, tell me where you are actually doing this.
Madam Chair, I honestly don't have the details of where it's currently available.
Madam Chair, having been at Ramona Foley, for the record, Assistant Director at Department of Human Services, I've been out in the counties visiting recently, and they are using the client index to try to determine when a new case comes up, and you mentioned particularly a child who's in foster care. When the Child Protective Service report comes in, they use the client index to try to determine whether or not the family is already known to either the child welfare system or is the family known to any of the other categories of assistance. And the idea behind the client index is ultimately to move us to a place where workers are not spending time repeating information that's already in the system, but are able to access that information. As you know, the systems across the old divisions are legacy systems, and they are independent of each other. And the client index is a way of using information technology to try to cross those old systems to make sure that if you are working with a child who comes into foster care, you would know whether or not those parents are eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. You would know if they've been on temporary assistance needy families, which then will end because of the child being removed from the family. But it's to try to make those connections. And historically, as Jerry says, those connections have been easier to make in small rural areas because of the size of the caseloads than there have been in the metropolitan areas.
I'm going to try to phrase this very carefully. It's from a point of view of watching a client go through a system, whether they're a big city, a small city, or a rural area, it is not logical to me that they go see five or six different people, repeat many of the same questions over and over again, and end up chewing up all kinds of bureaucratic time and effort and financially sucking up dollars that should go to the client. And so I really have a difficult time accepting the premise that because it's a big city versus a small city that it, or a rural area that can't be, that it has not been done already. I think it's a result of history of how we've done things more than actual need. I just have a hard time accepting that. And I've known of clients who have gone to various people and said they all ask me the same question, and they all sit there, took the information in, and then the next person I went to asked me the same questions. Well, somebody's paying for those people to ask those questions and to repeat that and make the effort over and over and over again. And that's what I'm concerned about here. And I could look at other things here and say, hey, why isn't housing in this? And they're going to go to a housing person and ask the same questions again. And, you know, if we're really going to help these people in an efficient fashion, I think we have to cut through somehow that bureaucratic red tape. We talked about this 3 years ago. We're talking about it again today. And I don't know if progress has been made or not made at this time, but I'm concerned that we're not making the kind of progress we need to really put an efficient system together that doesn't waste money in a bureaucratic maze that we've got ourselves sort of entangled into and can't get out.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to go back to the information you provided about the growth in the food stamp caseload. I believe you said, Mr. Burns, that the food stamp cases are going up 2,300 per month. And so if it, and that you're seeing the addition of 10 additional cases per caseload. 10 additional cases or 10 additional case workers?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it's 10 additional workers per month, 5 additional support staff, and 1 manager that we would earn on the basis of an additional 2,300 cases.
Okay. What I want to go to is I need to better understand how these cases are being managed. If it's 1 to 250 now and the number of cases is going up, what does that mean in everyday terms? Are you looking at after hours, after 5, Saturdays? How is one person managing these huge numbers?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, offices are having to be as creative as possible around responding to this. As I mentioned last Thursday, most offices in the state have created some sort of a processing function where those families and individuals that are receiving food stamps that have fairly stable situations go into caseloads where, in fact, the average is 500 to 600 cases per worker so that they can specialize the function. I would also say that oftentimes those case managers that would normally dedicate their time to the jobs program and serving families who are receiving temporary assistance to needy families are also now doing food stamp intakes. And we are using, I think in some areas, it is absolutely essential to use overtime, that people come in on Saturdays or they work late in order to keep up with the caseload.
Jerry, these your caseload staff. Can you give us the, not on a give us an average daily new cases on a daily basis, which has a, and then how many are completed within either a daily time span, because food stamp eligibility is a little different than an ongoing case, and how often you have to review the food stamps, unlike a foster care case or some of the other cases. Because I don't.
Madam Chair, would you like that to be broken out by program area?
Yes, it, okay. I think that it would have a better understanding because there's some different steps that are involved in food stamp determination, that eligibility, than it is when you're talking care in a foster care case or some of the other types of cases at the agency. Right. It will be, I think, a lot clearer for this these members, for the members to understand what is the activity that's involved in that kind of eligibility.
Madam Chair, we can put something together.
And Madam Chair, just as a follow-up, that's very helpful. But it would also be additionally helpful to understand how much overtime is being used in order to meet the service needs, trends, patterns, projections, to help us get a handle on the cost associated with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we can put that together, too.
Thank you.
Senator Shield.
I noticed another one. This emergency assistance, 1 to 90 cases. Is that the emergency assistance? What was it? $300 or $350 a month, and now it's in the next governor's budget going to be cut to $100 a month? Is that the one?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that's the one which actually at this point doesn't have any funding in it.
Yeah, it doesn't have any now. My real question, Madam Chair, is if we end up with an emergency assistance in the governor's budget that's projected at only $100, do you think anybody will use it, or will you need those caseworkers, or, you know, what I'm saying? At some point, you might as well not have it, so I guess what I'm saying.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, my experience with this is that if it was $20, that families would come in to ask for it. That when your needs get desperate enough, you'll go through any hoop to try and meet it.
Okay.
I want to go back a little bit because I am. I would like to know at some point what progress the agency is making or will make with respect to Dr. Bates. Still will make you Dr. Bates.
Doc is fine.
You know, one of the underpinnings or the focus of the reorganization was to get at the whole issue of clients having to go from place to place to place to have to give the same kind of information to the various entities. And part of the charge to the agency was to begin to set in place a process where individuals do not have to continue to go through all these various doors. And so, I mean, I think it is still, I know for me personally as a legislator, want to see some movement where individuals are not having to go through all these various doors to get their service needs met. And I kind of hear you saying this morning, Jerry, that we're probably a long way away from that concept. That's probably it's easier in the rural areas to do rather than in the metropolitan Portland areas to do that. And is that because of, one, the intake process isn't in place, two, is the confidentiality issue still an issue? What really is the reason that we're not able to have a common intake system within the department?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I was pointing to a single...
Or multiple, I just need to...
Well, a single dominant issue is that each of our programs has its own computer system at this point. So workers often do have to do the multiple entry. Other limitations, I think, that we've had have been rising caseloads while we have been trying to accomplish a reorganization of the department and train staff into some understanding and appreciation of what the other programs are and how to make the referrals and do the linkages. We've also moved a number of staff so that, in fact, clients don't have to go from office to office. I can tell you, certainly would have done more of that, but we've had budget limitations as well. But a part of what we need to do as we look at, kind of step back and look at where we are with reorganization and integration, is really make sure that those are kind of as deliberate and as planned as possible so that, in fact, we aren't setting people back instead of forward by moving either too many staff or too few staff or not having adequate preparations for when they move into another facility and having adequate support. I can give you just sort of a couple of small examples from the Portland area, which I'm most familiar with, where we've moved child welfare staff into self-sufficiency offices to find that the juvenile court has said, we only send our mail packets to your five primary child welfare offices. We will not send them to the self-sufficiency offices because we have our own budget problems. So we've now added a couple of extra days for them to get information from the courts when they're working with a case. We have issues where we've moved staff into facilities and are now finding that either we don't have an adequate number of state cars for the staff who are there or that we don't have an adequate number of visiting rooms when families come to the office. So it's those kinds of, sometimes it breaks down over those sort of logistical issues as well.
You know, Jerry, these discussions were going on 30 years ago when I was with the department.
I agree.
And, you know, when the department was created as in coordination in 1969, became a department in 1971, you know, the whole concept and the idea was to have a central intake system. 32 years later, I'm back here still talking about a common intake system so that we're not bouncing people, the very people that we serve, around in a system. I just, you know, if I sound frustrated, I am, because I think that the primary reason for the department is the people that you serve. And to say that it's about a car or about this, and I know that there are budgetary constraints, but I also know that somehow we need to be able to serve these individuals in a way to where they're not having to be bounced from place to place. And I, you know, I said it years ago, that's why I asked you about the confidentiality issue. And I know that computer systems may not talk to each other, and somehow we'll get to computers talking to each other. But I do think people can talk to each other, you know, and somehow people have to talk to each other so that we're not running these people around the mulberry bush kind of thing. That's my frustration. I won't lay it on you, Jerry, but I just think 30-some years of planning this and still talking about the revolving door. And we know that we're treating people with multiple problems and multiple needs, and to have to run them through multiple intakes, to me, is ludicrous.
Madam Chair, I'd say you adequately represent the frustrations of our staff as well.
And I know I represent the frustration of the client.
Right.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I guess that begs the question, then, why aren't we reforming and improving?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think that this is one of those where if, in fact, it was solely and strictly under the control of the state of Oregon, we probably would have fixed this by now. But oftentimes these are programs that are governed by federal regulations and federal standards, and those come with their own each comes with its own set of problems and challenges. And that it is continually working not only locally about how we put systems and processes together, but it's also getting some acknowledgement and some support from the federal government that their systems, they are creating systems and expectations and regulations and laws that are simply incompatible.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
I don't mean to beat on you here, but it's just there is a great deal of frustration. You mentioned that rural workers, since they have nobody else there in the office with them, somehow manage to provide all these services as an individual or a few people working in an office. The people coming to them must have the same problems all the way across the board, and they somehow manage to get that done as an individual. And I'd like to hear your comment on that. I'd also like to know how well the attempt at a single outlet for people in White City has actually worked. I was there when they opened it up. It's in a community I know well. I lived in that community for years. I still have many, many friends there. My sense is that has worked well, and that they've even gone into the local schools and put social workers there, and that it's been a sort of an encompassing single system that seems to be working. But I don't know for sure. I'd like to have a comment on both of those, if you could, for me, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I'd say that one of the distinctions between the urban areas and the rural areas in terms of the staff ability to deal with those kind of clients who are receiving multiple services is that couple of things. One is that oftentimes they simply don't have the volume of clients that are coming through the door that exists in urban areas. So the opportunity to make contacts actually is significantly enhanced, that there are not nearly the number of either other community agencies who've had involvement with the family, nor sometimes advocates who are representing the clients and want to have some participation in the planning, that those sorts of logistics are reduced in smaller areas. In some of our smaller offices, in fact, while the caseload standard may be 1 to 90, that if there's a fewer number of staff, a fewer number of cases than that, we still need to give whole bodies. So they will actually be, they could be slightly overstaffed in comparison to an urban area.
Jared, could you provide me, you mentioned that there are some federal impediments. Could you provide me with what those impediments are in dealing with the federal counterparts, so I can, you know, looking at whatever rules or that they have promulgated that keep us from getting to a common intake system? I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Could I ask a follow-up question?
Yes, you may.
When you break out the numbers for the number of clients per caseworker or intake worker, I'd like to have you separate that from rural and urban. I want to see if there's really a difference. I mean, you have a greater volume in the big cities, but you have more workers too. So I'd like to have an idea if it's a matter of a smaller caseload in the rural areas, or whether or not it's just more mass confusion there. And the second thing was I asked for a comment on the White City operation, if you can give me one, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, be happy to follow up on your the numerical difference between the urban and the rural areas. I'd add just one comment in terms of my own experience in the field, is that I don't believe that in human services there's really any economy of scale. As the numbers go up, the complications increase. In terms of White City, I still believe that people in the department, I think, still believe that it is a model. It works exceptionally well, that there have been people from across the country as well as across the state who visited White City to look at the lessons that they've learned in the process that they follow.
So is it working or not working?
Madam Chair, I believe it's working. I think it's working very well.
And the ability to replicate?
Madam Chair, that's another set of challenges. You're looking at a fairly small community where people have developed relationships over an extended period of time and have a facility that works for them. Trying to replicate that across the state can be done, but is not something that gets done over a couple of years. It's a long-term
process. Then I'm going to ask a fundamental question, because the multi-service center in Albina was the first that was developed. It was developed, in fact, it was developed by my spouse and Ted in the McCullough years. So they're in a common place in one building. Can you tell me if that kind of a model is working or not working? And that's in an urban area.
Madam Chair, I'll give you one example of how difficult it can be. The child welfare people and the self-sufficiency staff are in the same building. The child welfare folks refer to the building as North-Northeast, and the self-sufficiency people refer to it as Albina. We even have separate names for the same building. One of the things that we've done over the last year and a half is to move some of the child welfare folks from their side of the building over to the self-sufficiency side of the building. And what I heard from directly from staff was that there were immediate improvements in terms of people's ability to simply walk down the hall and ask a question about whether this family might be eligible for food stamps or do we have a protective service issue here. That sometimes even being in the same building, that folks don't know one another and that there are lots of barriers that exist. It's the building that has probably about 85 child welfare staff and at one point had about the same number of self-sufficiency staff. It's probably down to about 40 now. So it is working. It's working on a very small scale compared to White City.
Madam Chair, I'll make one last comment real quick. I probably had too much caffeine today, but your goal in your department, and I hope your goal is to make people self-sufficient, to improve communities. The White City community has gone through a transformation in the midst of a recession over the last 10 years. That used to be known as a community, and I don't think anyone would call it being unfair, because I've lived there and have friends there, that had one of the highest felony rates, one of the most unsafe places you could live 10 or 15 years ago. Because of what's been going on there, primarily because of your department, that has been a community that has transformed itself, and not by people migrating to another part of the state or leaving the area, but by low-income people becoming self-sufficient and solving a lot of their drug and crime problems through that integrated, simple, straightforward system that really helps people. I do not understand yet why that cannot be transferred across the state. I just don't get it, and maybe that's me. But I'm afraid it's not me that doesn't get it. I'm afraid it's your department that doesn't get it, and that's what really concerns me. I know there are well-meaning, hard-working people out there. They do the very best they can, but they need help in transforming themselves into a system that works better. And that takes real leadership, real positive attitude, and it's a difficult thing to do. But I've seen it happen in one community, and I'd like to see it happen across the state.
Going to move on. I think you hear this message that's coming here because it's terribly frustrating. I think most of the workers and the staff actually want to serve the people that come in to them. Somehow, you mentioned the distinction between the protective service and the child welfare service worker. Somehow, the message has got to be that everybody's serving the individual who walks through that door, and regardless of whether it's a child welfare worker or regardless, I think we have set up boxes and divisions, and by setting up boxes and divisions, people, you know, it's a separation automatically as to who serves whom for what, and it is troubling because the loser is actually the client. You know, the loser in all of this is the very person that we're serving because we're sending them through multiple doors and multiple changes. And if we're frustrated, I can just imagine how staff can be frustrated, how the individual that we're serving is frustrated by it. And I would just hope that that we pull out some of the old plans and say, how can we make this happen, what's happened in Fall City? White City, how can we make the original concept of the Department of Human Services a reality 30-some years later, that the individual person is the focus of why we're here, particularly since we recognize that most families that come to us are coming with multiple problems. You know, it's not like they're entering in the door for one reason, but they're entering the door with multiple situation problems.
Madam Chair, one of the things I think is often confusing, and we have to revisit with staff pretty regularly, is the difference in intake and assessment. And I think intake, when you look at it at its very simplest, intake is gathering some demographic information, trying to determine what's the presenting problem, why has this individual entered the door. Once that information is determined, I think that is when you start seeing programs with specialization, because the same set of questions you will ask that individual who comes in and says, I don't have any groceries, I have no money for food, and I need to apply for something. I think they call it a food stamp program. That individual has one set of needs, and an assessment will take that individual through an eligibility process defined by federal government for the food stamp program. However, if that individual says, I have no one to stay at home with my children, and I'm leaving my kids alone every day because I'm trying to find a job, they may find themselves talking to a child welfare worker, and the set of questions will be quite different once you move into an area called assessment. Later, when you hear about vocational rehabilitation, you will hear another example of once an individual comes through something, a portal called intake, and we gather the information that I agree has to be shared across the various places that individual may go. But I don't think we should leave the impression, or I wouldn't want to leave the impression, that the individual applying for eligibility for temporary assistance to needy families will have the same set of questions asked that someone who has been reported for abusing their child, because that will be a very distinct set of questions related to a child protective service assessment. So I think there are places we can go further as an agency in terms of sharing the information, gathering intake information, and hopefully trying to foresee some of the problems that these families have. But I think I would want to believe that there will also be an appreciation that you don't have the same exact set of questions in an assessment for child abuse that you would have if you were applying for emergency daycare, for example.
Absolutely. And your analysis that you gave was the very one that we talked about during the regular session, that you do have an intake, and then you have no different than if I went to the doc. Right. And or the hospital, you have a common central system that has intake, and from there you may go to X-ray, or you may go to surgery, you may go to, but and you have a different set of questions, and I concur with that. I think what the Representative Bates and I are saying, we want to know when those kinds of systems are going to get in place, when you are going to have a common intake system, and I recognize that some of it is technologically driven. Some of it may be because of federal issues, and that's why I asked the question of what is it specifically that is there that forms the impediment for us to move towards where we're having call it integrated system or whatever kind of name you want to put on it. But it's a system that allows for common intake, that allows for these assessments and these other things to take place, so that the person, if they don't get bounced around in our system, whether it's going to voc rehab, whether it's going to apply for food stamps, whether it's the child welfare system, whichever part of our system, so that we're not running people through all these various doors.
And, Madam Chair, it really accommodates two kinds of situations. One, the volume of families, and this is by and large the largest percentage of families who walk into the door to voluntarily apply for something, versus the kind of intake and assessment that will be done if it's what we call a coercive service. In other words, the majority of our Child Protective Services clients do not come in voluntarily asking for services.
Right.
A few do, but most of those will be taken in through an intake process that's prescribed by law and regulation. But again, the importance of making the connection so we're not repeating work, we're not duplicating work, and we're able to offer a family a set of services that meets more than one need, hopefully so that the multiple needs are met at the time the assessment is completed.
Senator Pat?
Ramona, I have some, listening to Jerry's comments about the physical facilities issue, I have some ideas after just recently leaving an agency as president's ELI, have experienced some things with these agencies. So, Madam Chair, I'd be glad to sit down with you and the department and shed some insight and some light onto that, because I think that co-location is quite simple. I think intake is complicated, but nevertheless, we can continue to work toward a common and a shared sense of intake in what I call cross-pollinated questions that might could take place. But I think the physical location, Jerry, you're right, present a real issue when people are so co-located. So at some time, I'd like to talk with you about that.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Page 16 and 17 give examples of performance reports that the department uses. These two happen to be examples from the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family and the Jobs Program. But what I wanted to do is just cite them as examples of the kind of performance reporting system that we're attempting to refine across all of our programs. That the first one on page 16 is really an excerpt from a report that goes out to one of the local service delivery areas, and it tells by month how many job placements were actually made, what their target had been, and then what percentage of the target was realized. This is a fairly simple report, and what it can be used for by a manager is to work with both their staff as well as contractors to look at what are the trends and what sorts of things might we do different in order to improve performance. The report on page 17 is an example of the kind of formatting that we would like to do in both child welfare, self-sufficiency, and vocational rehabilitation programs, where this is one where it essentially starts with giving sort of a macro perspective about the number of clients who are involved in jobs activities, and it makes a comparison from among each of the 16 service delivery areas. This report comes out monthly so that each service delivery area manager can look at how they're doing in comparison to the other areas of the state. The same report can also be done at the service delivery area, where it breaks out a comparison of each of the offices in the service delivery area, and then you can actually go down even further than that to the unit level or to the worker level to see how each worker is doing. It's a model of the approach that we would like to have for child welfare performance, where we believe that we're really on the verge of being able to put just this kind of a chart together by service delivery area and by office. And to be able to, vocational rehabilitation currently really has this capacity, and we want to be able to reach a point in the future where we identify really what our most important performance areas are. We're producing this kind of a data report on a monthly basis that goes out to folks that can tell them at a macro level how they're doing, and it can actually then take you down to the worker, and a worker can see what their contribution to that overall performance is. I thought that I would, on page 19, in the middle of the page, it lists a number of the factors that affect service. Most of these, I think all of these, have actually been covered by the program folks as they have discussed their specific areas. I thought I would just close by telling you that I was a service delivery area manager for most of the last 18 months and actually have been in this job for about 6 weeks. And from the conversations that I've had and heard from Gene Thorne, from Ramona, and from what I know about folks in the field, what I've been saying is that we really have three big issues in the field that we're currently dealing with. And this is really kind of apart from the turmoil that we have around program reductions. And those three areas are around communication, staffing, and performance data. That communication is first and foremost really putting the message and the philosophy out that Gene Thorne has started, where there really is a freedom to speak, that we really value diversity of opinion and disagreements, and that we want people to know that. The second part of it is around communication, is really opening the channels between central office and the field, so that people feel like there really is a freedom to have direct contact with those in central office or those in the field who know what's going on. In terms of staffing, this is really making sure in these sort of difficult times that we have both the minimal and the essential level of infrastructure to run our programs. And then it's assuring that the staffing that we do have is in fact equitably distributed across the state, and that we're constantly vigilant about changing caseloads and changing conditions so that we can adjust staffing to respond to those. And then the third area is really around the performance reporting. It is really getting to a reliable set of data reports that we can produce regularly that tell both workers and managers how we're doing about the most important performance areas of the department. Those are the things that we'll be working on.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, this information comes to me anecdotally, but I would ask it. My understanding is that in central IT, that there's a batch process, and I'm not a computer person, so, but I can conjure up visualization of what a batch process means versus electronic transfer of data, of 24 boxes a night of reports that are then circulated to the respective field offices. Could you comment on that if it's an outrageous anecdotal piece of information, or is it in fact some truth to it?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'm not a computer person either, but I have somebody who seems to admire them, so I'll let Jim Neely answer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Department of Human Services. And Madam Chair, Senator Morse, probably our largest system, what we call our client maintenance system, dates back to the early 70s, and it is indeed a batch processing system. And even though we can enter data online, this is a system that updates automatically every night. So it runs from 7 o'clock at night till the wee hours of the morning. Between that system, the other old mainframe systems that are really not real-time systems, they produce a lot of reports. Some of those are available electronically to us, but we do still move a lot of paper around. So I don't know if 24 boxes is accurate, but it would not surprise me.
Follow-up?
That has to have a follow-up question. What opportunities are there to streamline and build in the efficiencies and the outcomes that would make the system work better?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, the systems that we tend to bring on these days, to the extent that we bring on new systems, very often have an entirely different purpose. For instance, our track system is a case management system. It's done with newer technology, and it's really done in a way that input and output is done electronically. The older systems that we have tend to be payment systems more typically than case management systems, and yet more and more we're in the case management business. So I think over time most of the newer technology that ultimately will replace some of the systems that we have now, most of that technology is built on the notion that if you don't have to print something out, you shouldn't print something out. And I think we believed at one point that when we got through the year 2000 issues that we would have updated a lot of our old systems, or that they would not make it through the year 2000. The good news is that they did make it through the year 2000, and the bad news is that they did make it through the year 2000. They are hugely expensive to try and replace, and it really is an incremental change that we're able to bring along with these.
Will we be getting into some of these issues when we get into statewide support systems?
Madam Chair, that's exactly correct. And you'll have our Chief Information Officer here to ask some specific questions about that.
So save up all your questions for the IT systems.
Even when they did come for upgrading systems, it was like the legislature had all of us had our clown suits on. We want it, but we don't want to pay for it.
Yes, and we took it away. What little we did give them to do some of this, we took it away from them. So, you know, we give it with the one hand and we take it away with the other.
Consequently, the bad system.
That's correct. Thank you. So, Senator Morris, you have to keep that in mind when they come before us, that it's a give it and a take it away process sometimes up here. Ramona.
Madam Chair, did you have further questions for Jerry Burns?
Do any of the members of this panel have any additional questions of Jerry? So thank you, Jerry.
He's going to get away from
him. If not, I believe we're ready to move to.
Jerry, is this your first experience before this body in a long time?
Madam Chair, in a long time, yes.
Well, welcome to.
I feel very good about it.
Lighter in the pocket.
So if this is the committee, I think we're ready to move to vocational
okay.
rehabilitation program.
You're on now.
I already did my time.
No, you didn't. You're up now. Okay.
I thought I said something inappropriate to Sheila. I didn't even know.
Actually, Madam Chair, I did my overview on Thursday.
You did?
I did.
Well, let's see. Should we have her say something just for the record?
Mm-hmm. For the record, my name is Cindy Jones. And
we're in a good mood today, Cindy. Who do we have with us from Spoke Rehab? Tina, and she has all the money. And Ted, Tina, you have all the money?
All the money?
It says Tina Treasure.
I do. I have money for Rosie. I have money for Rosie.
Oh, well.
I don't know about all the money, but anyway.
Well, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'll go ahead and pay Rosie because although I'm a very optimistic person by nature, I'll know I'll never make it through this time without acronyms, so I'll go ahead and contribute and expect Ted to do the same.
Thank you.
I'm not write your name down anymore.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tina Treasure, and I'm the Acting Administrator of the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and I've held that position for a whole 3 weeks now. So with me today is Ted Swigert, the Field Services Manager for our program, who will be assisting in the presentation. The mission of the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services is to assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve and maintain employment and independence. Our goals for the coming biennium are outlined on pages 4-3 of your handout and include things such as increasing competitive job placements, expanding partnerships with workforce investment boards, employers, schools, and various community agencies, increasing the diversity of our clientele and staff, and maximizing technology to increase performance. I have to say, as I read the guiding principles that were set out by your committee, it struck me just how many of the services of the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services align with those principles. And before we start our program overview, I'd just like to touch on a couple of those. One is the principle that you've said of maximizing the state and local partnerships to assure optimum program delivery. The Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Program has extremely successful and long history of doing state and local partnerships. We have, in fact, under federal law, a lot of actually numerous mandated partners like the Workforce Services Delivery Systems, education at all levels, Centers for Independent Living, Developmental Disability Services, mental health, community rehab programs, and, of course, businesses and employers. So you can see that we have a pretty wide network. For a small agency, we are spread pretty thin among a lot of partnerships that we have. We also tend to use a lot of nonprofit and independent entities on the local level to provide some of the services that we provide, such as job coaching, mentoring, and placement services. We've developed some rather unique linkages with the medical community also. An example is here in Salem at the State Rehabilitation Hospital, where we have an outstation counselor, which enables us to identify individuals that are new to disability. While someone new to disability may not be ready at the present time for employment, having that access for that individual to see that employment is a big part of rehabilitation really saves a lot of time when they're looking at what rehabilitation really means to them and gets them back thinking about being productive and self-sufficient in a far faster fashion. So we think that is one of the unique things that we do. Another one of the principles that caught my eye was to maximize the state general fund dollars by capturing federal matching funds where available and leveraging other funds. I have to say that I think this is where the Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program excels, in that we enjoy one of the highest match rates in the department at 4-1. So that means for every 20 cents that we can use of either state dollars or other funds that we can garner, we can draw down 80 cents of federal dollars. And so that pushes us not to only use our state funds wisely to do that, but to partner with schools, with Centers for Independent Living, and others that provide services that are auxiliary to our services to make it possible to bring the most federal money to Oregon that's possible and provide the most thorough, holistic services. There's, of course, other principles that I, when I read through them, that I thought we align well with, but I won't go into those, and I'm hoping as we go through our presentation that those will become clear to you. The Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, individuals with all types of disabilities, that's physical, mental, and developmental disabilities. The only group of individuals with disabilities that is not served under our system are people who are blind, and those individuals are provided vocational services through the Office of the Oregon Commission for the Blind.
Is there any particular reason why you do not serve the blind, other than it's a separate entity under the commission?
States have a choice as to whether or not they want to run their vocational programs as one entity or two. And in this state, there has been the Commission for the Blind, who's traditionally provided services to the blind. So where there are two separate agencies, we are, you know, forbidden to provide services because they do.
How many states have a split function?
Do we know? I don't think that we have that information, but we'd be happy to write that down and get that information back to you, Madam Chair. The Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program is really designed to do four simple but yet complex things. One, assess. Two, plan. Three, develop. And four, provide rehabilitation services to eligible individuals with disabilities.
Question, isn't the Blind Commission on your advisory group? Is there members from the Blind Commission serve on your...
On the State Rehabilitation Council? Yes, there's a representative from the Blind Commission. Each individual's plan that's developed within our service system is unique and mutually developed with the counselor. It's a joint process between the client and the counselor. The services must be consistent with their strengths, the abilities, interests, and informed choice of our clients. There are really four primary programs administered by the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and I believe they're outlined on pages 4-4 and 4-6 of your handout. By far the largest is the Basic Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program. In 2003-2005, we expect to serve 28,000 consumers. We expect approximately 9,700 to enter into employment plans and approximately 6,400 to be closed successfully in employment. Approximately 97% of people that we serve meet the federal definition of severely disabled. And that means that individuals have multiple disabling conditions and need a wide variety of services, including extensive counseling, guidance, intervention, and support services. Another one of our programs is the Youth Transition Program, which assists students with disabilities to bridge the gap from school to work. OVRS has cooperative relationships with over 40 school districts, and we now operate in more than 90% of high schools in Oregon with this program. This highly successful program has as its goal to assist school districts to focus on employment outcomes for students with disabilities and to work with school personnel to assist in that transition that students have to make from school to work, to community college, to higher education, all depending upon the needs of that student. I might add that this is another one of the programs that I think align well with one of your guiding principles, in that addressing the problems of children early to avoid long-term costs while these are not per se children, they are youth, and catching them at the age that they're going to transition is far more cost effective, as when you catch them at that age, they're far more likely to gain employment and retain employment. So we really value our youth transition program. The one of the last programs I want to talk about is the Supported Employment Services Program. And this is a program through which consumers who are deemed too severely disabled to really enter the workforce without extensive intervention and ongoing supports are served. Basic rehabilitation services are provided to these individuals on a somewhat time-limited basis, and then support services with our partners, such as the Developmental Disabilities Program, mental health programs, and other community organizations, and at times even their families, that transitions made. An example of ongoing support might be a job coach for an individual on at a work site. This project is estimated to serve about 500 clients in this next biennium. The last program that I want to talk to you about that we administer is the Independent Living Program. The primary focus of this program is to assist individuals with severe disabilities in maintaining or increasing their level of independence at home, in the community, or in employment. And currently, these services are primarily provided by community-based, nonprofit, consumer-controlled Centers for Independent Living. We have around five longstanding centers in the state right now, one in Portland, Roseburg, Grants Pass, Bend, and in Klamath Falls. Over the last 2 years, two new centers have been established, one in Ontario and one in Lincoln City. And there are grassroots entities now operating in four other locales, which are Medford, Coos Bay, Salem, and Eugene. It's estimated that about 12,000 people are served in this program. And that's a real basic overview of what the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services does. And I, unless you have some specific questions, I would like to ask Mr. Swigert to talk a little bit more about our service delivery process, some of the types of services that we provide, consumer profiles, and some cost comparison data.
Are there any questions? Mr. Swigert.
Okay. My name is Ted Swigert, and I'm the Field Services Manager for the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. And what I'd like to do is review with you parts of the materials that we have previously provided you. And if we could start on page 4-7, and that page is titled Services Provided to Achieve Employment. Really, this page reflects the rehabilitation process. And the first step in that in the process is assessing the barriers to employment or the disabilities to determine eligibility. And eligibility is really a fairly simple process to determine within vocational rehabilitation. There are really three elements. Number one is there has to be a diagnosable mental or physical condition. Two, that condition must be an impediment to employment. And three, the individual must require vocational rehabilitation services to get a job. So that's as easy as it is in terms of whether a person is eligible for voc rehab or not. Now, I do want to emphasize that vocational rehabilitation has an employment focus. That, in fact, is our total job. And often people have misconceptions about what we can do in helping a person get to employment. And especially with our association with the Department of Human Services, where other programs provide maintenance kinds of activities. In fact, vocational rehabilitation cannot provide maintenance needs such as housing, cash assistance, medical, or food. We can provide some of that in a very short term, very limited basis, only as it relates to that person going to work. Another area that we differ from the rest of the department in is that we have no income criteria for eligibility. So people coming to us can get services regardless of income or resources. And so consequently, we tend to get people from not only within the department, but throughout our communities.
What is the, from the time a person comes to the agency to voc rehab What is the length of time that it takes them to go through assessment till eligibility is determined?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually we have 60 days to process the eligibility, and in fact, I think when we talk about numbers later, but maybe I'll touch on it right now, we have a lot of folks that do come to us looking for help, and they do have disabilities. And when I was mentioning that eligibility criteria to you, sometimes we can help people get jobs much faster than going through the process of determining eligibility and getting all the medical documentation, et cetera, which is really what takes the time, the 60 days. And what we try to do is get them hooked up with the resources that we have within workforce in terms of just getting them jobs. So we never even get them to eligibility. Also, I would like to mention that while we have 60 days by law, our average, I think, is about 41 days for people to be determined eligible in our system.
Those are the individuals that you're trying to get into vocational training, are?
Right, exactly. Yes, ma'am.
Senator Carter.
So, Mrs. Swiger, if a person is indeed drug and alcohol considered a rehabilitative act?
Drug and alcohol is considered a disability. Quite frankly, the folks that we're serving these days, while drug and alcohol is oftentimes a disability they have, it is usually in conjunction with other disabilities as well. We are serving the most severely disabled population in Oregon, which simply means that the folks that we see have multiple barriers to employment. Alcohol and drug is certainly one, and we have some numbers for you that you can kind of see what are the primary disabilities that we're serving, but also secondary disabilities as well.
And I don't know if it's in the material, but if it isn't, could you provide it? And that is because you had mentioned mental health included in the disability, and I don't know, at one time it was not. Could you give us some of the categories that you work with so we could have a better understanding of the population and what some of those disabilities are?
Right. Actually, that information is coming up, and I will point it out to you as I
Thank get
there.
You.
After the assessment that we do, the assessment around the person's disability is kind of the first step. But I have to tell you that the most important aspect of the services that we provide to people really aren't about their disabilities. What our focus is on their abilities and their interests, because that's where we're going to go in terms of them going to work. And so what we do there, the next step after that assessment, is a combination of counseling, job exploration, testing, providing support services, training, and through training we could be school training or on-the-job training or special needs training, and then finally job development and placement. In all of this, one of the very important aspects of our services is client choice, in that the client, as we work through their rehabilitation and help them determine the areas that they want to, where they want to focus on in terms of employment goal, they are very much a partner in this process. Also, that final goal for us is placing person in employment, in competitive employment. And for vocational rehabilitation, again, how we define a job placement is different than what you may hear from a lot of different programs, only within the department, but also within workforce. Because for us, a job placement does not happen, is not counted, until the person has been on the job for 90 days, 90 consecutive days. So that's a very important element. So when we talk about the job placement numbers that we have, those are people who have been in a job for 90 days. And then after job placement, we also provide support services for up to 1 year, so that we're there to provide any kind of services that will help that person keep that job after the 90 days for up to a year. In all of this, in providing these services, the partnerships are really key to success for us, and our partnerships are across a wide range of community partners, which include education. And through education, I'm thinking K-12 community colleges, a variety of training programs, also the workforce, which is the employment department, and of course the Workforce Investment Act partners, et cetera. Business, we have a lot of connections with business in terms of our jobs and training sites. And then the human service agencies, of course, not only the Department of Human Services and all the various programs that are administered directly by the department, but also mental health, alcohol and drug, and then various community human service agencies, Goodwill, St. Vincent de Paul, et cetera. The next section I wanted to talk with you about is on page 4-8 and 4-9. And this really illustrates the service delivery model for vocational rehabilitation in Oregon. And I did want to point out to you on 4-8 that we have listed here 121 trained vocational rehab counselors. And that is the group that serves and provides services for the state of Oregon, is 121 counselors. And sometimes I know that I know as much publicity as we get and as many good things as we do, I think people mistakenly think of us as a large program within the department, when in fact we're a very small program. And to kind of give you an idea of how we operate, if you look on page 4-9, which gives you a map of Oregon, let me tell you a little bit about one of our branch offices in the Eastern Oregon branch. And the Eastern Oregon branch as the branch manager, who's located in Baker City. But the actual branch runs, if you look at your map, from Hermiston, 240 miles to the south and east to Ontario. And so it includes offices with counselors in Hermiston, Pendleton, LeGrand, Baker City, and Ontario. And then in addition, it provides services in outstations in Burns, John Day, Enterprise, and Milton Freewater. So now let me kind of give you a microcosm of the Eastern Oregon branch, and if we consider LeGrand, which is a fairly significant population area in Eastern Oregon. In the LeGrand office, we have a counselor and a human services assistant who provides services not only to LeGrand, but also to the outstation that I mentioned earlier, which is Enterprise. And they are working, again, with the partners that I just mentioned before, education, workforce, business, and human services agencies. So we cover a lot of area and provide services to large populations with really a relatively small number of staff. Let me give you another example, if I may. In Salem, we have two offices in Salem and two branch managers. And let me talk about one that's most familiar to me, because several years ago I ran this particular office. And it's the one listed here under Marion Polk Counties on your map. And it says Wyneema Job and Career Center. And then it says SCO, which stands for Salem Community Outreach. That is a branch office. And under that branch, we have counselors. We have two counselors there. The Wyneema is out at Chemeketa Community College. We have two counselors there. Then we have a counselor at the Salem Hospital Rehab Unit, a counselor located at the Saniam Job and Career Center, which is out in Staten at the Chemeketa campus out there. We have a counselor up at Woodburn. We have two counselors downtown here at the employment department. And then in addition, that branch manager, who is located at Wyneema, that branch manager also covers the Yam Hill area, which we have an office in McMinnville where we have two counselors. And then those counselors also provide coverage for Sheridan and Newburg. So, again, we tend to cover large areas and partner with a large number of people. But we're a fairly small organization providing those services. If I could then have you turn to page 4-10. Has those consumer profiles that you're asking about. And the VR consumers reflect a wide range of people in our state and a wide range of primary disabilities, and we also have a wide range of occupations in which we place them in. If you look under the gender, age, and education, you'll see that the numbers are spread out fairly representative of the communities that we're serving. The primary disabilities that you were asking about, you can also see that we do provide some although a very small percent for visual impairment, although that does not include people who are blind. And then you can see the percentages in terms of the disabilities that we serve. Now, these are the primary disability, and oftentimes we have not only a primary but a secondary disability.
Brittany Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under orthopedic disabilities?
Yes.
I assume these are back injuries? Am I making an assumption I shouldn't?
Representative Bates, actually, orthopedic could be back injuries, but oftentimes what it is are, I think the thing we see the most common would be joint kinds of disabilities around knees and elbows, and then things like carpal tunnel. There would be just kind of a wide variety of issues.
Follow up. Are these long-term permanent disabilities we're talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, yes, these would be long-term, and these have to be through medical documentation. We have to demonstrate that, in fact, this disability constitutes an impairment or impediment for this person to be employed. Usually what we're looking at is that they're unable to continue the employment that they have previously had.
Madam Chair, later time, I'd like to take a look at some of that, if you would, for me. I know this is an area that where people that really do need help. It's also an area that has some questions sometimes that involve it. I'd like to take a quick look at those with you sometime. I don't want the committee's time for that.
Okay.
Would you also provide us with what's the average amount of time that the person has not been in employment before they come to Voc Rehab? And along that line, I know there used to be, you know, a considerable amount of time before the person ever got to Voc Rehab, and as a result, there was a need to have, some motivational changing, some attitudinal changes, and I don't know whether you're still having to do that now or whether they're coming in a lot earlier, but if you could provide us with the average amount of time that the person has been without employment before you actually determine their eligibility in Voc Rehab, that would be helpful.
Okay.
And under, I don't know what personality disorder means, so if both the doc and I, if you would break out the categories under mental illness and personality disorder, it would be helpful. Did I read you, Scott?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. You're being very politically correct in your questioning and doing a better job than I could.
Okay. We will have that information for you.
Thank you.
I did want to mention also that one of the things, when we look at the occupation at closure, in Oregon, we've been extremely proud of the fact that what we're trying to do is get people into competitive employment. And bottom line, here's what that means. Our goal here is to get people real jobs that pay real wages and have real benefits. And quite frankly, in vocational rehabilitation across the nation, there have been lots of categories of work which do not necessarily give you those end results. In Oregon, it has been our focus that these are the type of jobs that we are trying to get people into.
Madam Chair. Senator Shields first.
Senator Shields.
We were just sitting down here kind of cogitating as to what's the kind of pay range that these people make, or are we jumping ahead on your report?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, actually, we will cover that. If you'd like me, I could cover that now, or we could cover it.
We could wait until you get there.
Okay.
President Bates?
I saw it's the next page up, but I was going to probably ask more questions, but we'll get there. I want to get a sense of the type of training you have for these people. Quite frankly, in the past, I've had patients who had disabilities, and I told them not to call you. I said, you're better off just go and get your money together, go and get yourself educated, get a 2 or 4 year college degree. That's the real access to the middle class, and we just kind of given up. I've noticed, however, in the last year or 2 years, that seems to be changing, and I've had clients go through your services and actually get some really serious training that helped them move forward. And I'd like to hear more about what has changed. It seems to have been a change in my area, at least, about what people are really getting from you. And it's a big step forward. I'd like to hear more about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, well, I think maybe what you're seeing is, I think in the last few years that the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation has really been working hard to develop our partnerships across the training spectrum. I think that we have developed some extremely good relationships with community colleges, for one, but and so the types of trainings that we get there have been, I think we've really improved in that area. I have to say, too, though, that there has been really a movement around workforce, and part of that movement, I think, has helped to bring community colleges into reality to some degree. I probably need to be careful with this, but in community colleges, the last few years, there's been a real focus on short-term training and short-term training that leads to jobs, and I think community colleges have really stepped up to meet that challenge. And our relationships with them, I think, has been extremely effective for the folks that we're serving. And I'm hoping that what you're seeing is reflective of those partnerships that we've been developing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
If I may move on now to page 4-11, I'd like to talk just a little bit about program growth or reduction. And the first chart that you have on this page reflects the growth from 1996 to 2001, which shows a 25% increase in the number of people that are coming to us to get services. And I would like to talk to you a little bit about why and how we've been serving more people, because I do want to mention to you that the 121 counselors has actually been something of a constant it's been way before my time. I want to say some 20 years, as that number has been fairly constant. But what we have done is gotten much greater efficiencies through the implementation of the computerized case management system. And this system is known as ORCA, which you may have heard of, and this, by the way, my money is up here. ORCA is an acronym, and it stands for the Oregon Rehabilitation Case Automation System. And the ORCA system has got to be one of the best computerized case management systems that I've ever seen. And what it has done, literally, in vocational rehabilitation, it was implemented back in around 95, 96 is when it really came online. What it's done is it has enabled us.
How much did that system cost?
Well, I believe the first we're in ORCA 2 right now, but the first time we bought ORCA, I believe it was less than $1 million for the whole system. And it was a system that we purchased and from a company called Alliance, and that company also provides a very similar system in, I believe, 13 other states. And so Oregon's really benefited from the fact that other states are using a system very similar. It is customized to meet our needs, but because we're involved in this system with these other states, the cost has really been held down. It's been a system, Madam Chair, that I had actually tried to introduce and kind of show some of my partners within the department. I'd worked for Adult and Family Services for a number of years, 8 years to be exact, and when we were working in Adult and Family Services, the case management system was something of a dream for all of us that would provide lots of support in doing, not only providing services to individual recording those things, as well as this particular system also makes financial payments. It also puts together all the federal reports that we're required to provide. Anyway, this system is that very system that, in a sense, I think we dreamed about in Adult Family Services. And it is a very impressive system because it provides not only a lot of information, but it really supports the counselors in providing services. Anyway, what I was getting to was that in addition to doing all the things I just mentioned, this particular system has really freed up our clerical staff, and in fact we've moved what we used to call clerical staff to human services assistants, so they now provide direct assistance to our clients and support the counselors in providing services. And it's from that we've really been able to not only provide more services, but we have gotten higher and higher rehab outcomes, employment outcomes, because of our ability to shift the work. In other words, they're doing less paperwork, quite frankly, and doing more client service work. That's the bottom line. The second chart on this page reflects the history of employment outcomes for vocational rehabilitation, and you can see also that there has been a steady increase until 2001, where there is a slight dip, and quite frankly, we think that there is going to be even a further reduction in client outcomes, and this is direct reflection on the economy. But we have been seeing here in the last 6 months or so of this year that those numbers are now starting to come back up. We've kind of regrouped and have been working extremely hard to make sure that we're focusing on jobs that exist today and jobs that are not being phased out as the economy suffers.
Senator Morris. Thank you. Very quick question. Is there some reason why we don't have 2002 data? You were referencing that, but I didn't see it.
I think I don't know that there is any reason other than I think this just ends the biennium, and we're still working on the 2002-2003 biennium and waiting for the final numbers at the end of June.
Can you have 2002 without getting 2003?
We can provide that information,
that would,
Madam Chair.
Helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
President Bates.
I don't know if you can get this information to us or not, but it would be of interest to me. When I think of voc rehab patients of mine who've gone through the system, they kind of fall in two broad and very broad categories. There is a group that is permanently disabled either for emotional reasons or a mental retardation or physical reasons that will need your support on a continuing basis to maintain even a minimum job, but they are very anxious to do that. And they only may be making minimum wage and probably, quite frankly, because of disabilities, will not be able to do more than that, and usually they have other social services helping support them. The second group is injured workers or people who have... this is politically correct again, who have no obvious impairment other than the particular one you're dealing with to prevent them from being fully employed. I'd like to know if those people are going into jobs that pay a living wage. That, for me, that's a job that's $12, $13, $14, $15 an hour and not $9. Because you may have two groups here. When you say if the average is $9, you may have two different groups involved. I'd like to see if the people who are really being rehabilitated for with no other significant factor other than the one you're dealing with are going out after your work and getting good, well-paid jobs or not. Does that question make sense to you?
Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think we can provide that information. I have to tell you that the jobs that we get really are a broad spectrum depending upon the person's abilities and skills and also, quite frankly, how much they're available to work. And so the wages do represent that ability to engage in employment. I would like to say, though, that, and we will give you the exact numbers, but our average wage at placement compares very favorably to all workforce programs in the state of Oregon. And so I think that that's significant when you consider the folks that we are working with.
I would agree.
I don't see it here. But what is, and you may have stated it and I missed it, what is the average time that a person is in your program, in voc rehab?
Madam Chair, I don't have that number with me right at the moment, but I will get that number for you.
I think it would be, well to know how long a person is in voc rehab before they... are released and employed.
The final page that I wanted to talk with you about is page 4-16. And this was a cost comparison page. It was the cost per case rate for Oregon, which is about $1,700 per person served, and that compares to the national cost per case rate of almost $2,000. And also in Oregon, the vocational rehabilitation program serves persons with the most severe disabilities. 97% of our caseload is categorized within that definition of most severe disabilities, which ranks in the top 5% of all VR programs in the nation.
Within your cost comparison, how do we compare with our neighbor to the north and our neighbor to the south?
Madam Chair, I can get those numbers for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. On page 13, there's a brief note about the Ticket to Work program, and if you could provide information as well about the how that program has been evaluated, how successful it's been. I note that the focus is on SSI, SSDI beneficiaries who go to work but also keep their health care benefits. So how's it working?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the Ticket to Work program is a federal program that Oregon was one of the pilot states for that particular program, and they had identified some 80,000 potential participants in the program, or people who could participate in the Ticket to Work program. And I believe that we have 100. Yeah, I believe that we currently have 200 people that are participating in that program, in the Ticket to Work program, out of those 80,000 that were potentially eligible for it.
How long has the program been in existence, and when will you be beginning to get data analysis to tell us what the results were?
Well, Madam Chair, the program rolled out almost a year ago when we first started getting the names, and people were advised through mail. They were notified through the mail as to whether they were eligible and how they could contact either vocational rehabilitation or any employment network. There were other private employment networks that could also provide services under the Ticket to Work. The numbers that they thought were going to be, that they thought would respond to the Ticket to Work were quite a bit smaller, obviously, than what we've experienced. I do have to say, and it will be a number I can get for you, but within vocational rehabilitation and the people that we serve, we already have actually a fairly high number of folks who are on Social Security, either SSI or SSDI, either regular Social Security or Social Security disability benefits, and provide services to those. We've been, I think, very effective in our and have had some strategies and efforts to help people who are on SSI and SSDI to identify us as a real resource for them. Because, quite frankly, here's the bottom line to all of this. Social Security doesn't pay enough for somebody to survive on, and we know that. And folks, as soon as you get around, or as soon as people get Social Security, there is some some modicum of security in a sense, because you get this check. Unfortunately, it just doesn't go far enough. And what we've done and what we've tried to do is provide opportunities for people on Social Security to get competitive employment.
And is your follow-up? How were the 80,000 potential candidates identified?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, what they did was they pulled a list of everybody in Oregon who was on SSI or SSDI, and then sent them notification of this Ticket to Work. It was a very elaborate program in some senses, in that they have quite a bit of resources available to people to find out about the program, toll-free phone calls, and they also sent out these materials that I'm talking about. We also had materials available to us. We educated the Department of Human Services in a number of we used EdNet and a number of mechanisms trying to educate people so that wherever they came into the system, they could hear about Ticket to Work. There were really some concerns, I think, for people on Social Security about what this program really was and whether they were interested in it. It is very much a voluntary program, and there are some really good benefits to it, but I think that obviously the sales job was questionable simply by looking at the results.
Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Were those people fearful of answering the questionnaire or getting involved in the program because of fear of losing the Social Security benefits?
I would have to say, Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Bates, I'd have to say, in my opinion, that would be one of the issues, although I do want to tell you that the program says that people who participate in the Ticket to Work program are held harmless from losing their benefits.
even we don't believe that.
Just a follow-up. When you say that the program says, is that also a reference to information that was mailed to or that was received by potential candidates? I mean, could you share an example of a letter or a sample letter that was sent so we could get a better understanding of how the program was marketed.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, we will happily give you all the information that was provided to individuals. And yes, it was in the literature, all the benefits of the program.
Mm-hmm. Maybe there was just a lack of trust.
Who would have thunk it? And Derek, can I ask a question?
Yes, I'll
just talk to you for a moment. Some of us have direct contact with these individuals all the time, so we kind of have an idea of what's going on out there sometimes. I was interested in page 16. That we've had a significant increase, and I think this is real, in people who have been applying for and accepted to voc rehab above the size of our population growth, and that, according to your statistics, the amount of disabilities, severe disabilities in Oregon is within the top 5% of the nation. Could you give me some idea of, is that a matter of us identifying them better? Is there something different about Oregon? Do you have any idea where those figures are coming out the way they are?
Hi, I'm Joe Miller. I'm also from the voc rehab program, Madam Chair, Senator Bakes. When we looked at that, part of this has been a choice in Oregon. We compared with our other partners across the nation, and we have put our emphasis on the most severely disabled here in Oregon versus just significantly disabled. And as a result of that emphasis for the last several years, we have gone up and up and up. So our people we're serving are much heavier severe disabilities than other states across the country. And our philosophy has been, and through all of our time, is that most people that have a limited, smaller type of disability can usually find work themselves or has a potential. We can refer them to a partner in a workforce that could help them where the most significantly severe cannot. So that's where our emphasis has been, and it's actually reflected in our percentages over the past several years.
Madam Chair, okay. And I would assume then the increase in percentages is as a result of you doing some type of outreach or something to contact these people and make an attempt to get them back to work. I mean, it's a laudatory. This has changed. I just want to know why.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I think that's been part of the case also. For vocational rehabilitation, we are integrated not only within the Department of Human Services, but we also are integrated by law with the workforce partners. And so as I was talking earlier about some of the areas where our counselors are actually located, in some cases we are located with workforce, in other words, with the Employment Department or with the folks who are doing the Workforce Investment Act, where we're right there with their resource rooms. And so when people are coming in to us and they do have disabilities, but those disabilities are not necessarily severe enough in terms of them going back to work, we can link them up right away with those resources and get them focused on jobs that they can get and get them back to work. Because oftentimes, I mean, for all of us, quite frankly, getting to work as soon as possible is really the goal. It is for our clients, but it is for people who are coming in to see us. And I think those linkages have really paid off for us here in the last few years.
Thank you.
Okay, well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm just going to wrap up by calling your attention to page 4-17 to relate to the performance measures. There's one key performance measure related to the Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Services in the links to the Oregon Benchmarks document, and that's what I want to reference. That benchmark measure is the percentage of adults with significant disabilities who are capable of working who are employed. And I would just like to comment on some progress that we have made toward this benchmark by referencing pages 4-19 through 4-21, where we get to some of the questions you asked earlier about wages and outcomes. The first relates to employment outcomes. While employment outcomes, as Mr. Swigert has mentioned, have slightly declined, primarily, we think, due to the poor economy, they're holding fairly steadily, as depicted in the graph on 4-19. And in fact, in a report, since I've been on the job for 3 weeks, I asked for last week and received, we are now at 104% of our projected rehabs to date this year. So we do have some indications that we are doing fairly well and on the rise in the last 6 months. The second relates to wages after receiving Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Services. The average wage at closure has risen to now over $9 per hour. And we do know in some preliminary 2002 reports that we've received, the average consumer in that year, actually the hourly wage rose to $9.26 an hour. And as Mr. Swigert said, that figure compares favorably to the average entry wage of any Oregonian being placed in employment and any other kinds of job placement services. And you can see that that has steadily increased since 1996. The third relates to client satisfaction, which is actually a cornerstone of our program. The Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation Services actually feels that client satisfaction is the key ingredient to our program's success and continued improvement. So in a recent external study conducted by the State Rehabilitation Council, it actually showed that we still have a very high percentage of consumers satisfied with the services that they are receiving. Areas that were identified appear on page 4-20 in your handout. Those were the kinds of questions that the survey asked of our consumers. And I found this very welcome news in light of the fact that in this economy it is hard, it is more difficult for people to find employment, and yet we have satisfaction rates so high among the people that we do serve. So that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, concludes our formal presentation. Are there questions that you would like to ask?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. It would be helpful if you would add to the consumer profiles on page 410 information on the race and ethnicity of people being served. That way we would be able to determine how you are meeting your 2003-2005 goals, specifically the two. One says that you plan to expand employment partnerships with tribal entities, African American, Hispanic, and Asian populations, and then you also plan to increase the diversity of people served, staff, providers. So again, if you'll give us data, that way we'll know how we're doing.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, we'd be happy to provide that. And while it wasn't provided in the materials that were developed actually before I took this position, I did do some exploration of just basic percentages of minorities that we're serving currently now, and found that in state fiscal year 01, 15% of the individuals we served were from ethnic minority groups, and in 2002 that was 14%. But we are working on some breakdowns of exactly what that means, and we'll provide that to you at a later date.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
A question, and to see if that particular issue has been worked through, and that was the issue of counseling offices and confidentiality that brewed all during the interim, whether or not that's no longer an issue.
Madam Chair, I knew that you would be interested in that question, and I'm happy that you asked. We've done a lot of partnershiping within the department, a lot of networking, a lot of actually exploration as to why that was such a big issue, and have found actually several reasons for that. One, as you know, the relationship that our counselors have with individuals with disability, like I mentioned, in a lot of circumstances, but especially around divulging medical information, talking about very sensitive issues around personal care and things like that, are highly sensitive nature. And so our counselors and actually our consumers were rightfully, I believe, concerned that would we have that level of privacy in an integrated setting. And so what we've really done is try to assess area by area, location by location, where we're co-located, how to provide that that privacy that's needed. And I believe that we are making success. We are really making strides in addressing that issue.
And the other issue of the cabinet status, is that no longer there?
Well, actually, Director Thorne and I had just had a conversation about that last week. And what she has chosen to do now, since they are taking a new look, a fresh look at basically how our services are going to fit in the department when they're realigned, we have decided that we're going to have weekly confers, both for my benefit and for hers, so that we can see exactly the progress that OVRS is making in more integrating itself within the department. So I believe that the State Rehab Council, which is the group who had the objections to us being removed from the cabinet, would still like to see that issue considered again, but right now are very, very happy with the cooperation we're getting from the department and the level of involvement that they seem to be wanting us to have these days.
Not all of the entities within the Department of Human Services enjoy or have the a council umbrella, and I'm very much aware of that. I have to tell you that part of my, when they contacted me, was that, you know, the ultimate objective is to serve the client. And I was around when the argument was made that the employment division didn't want to be a part of the department. I've been around when entities, because they happen to enjoy a federal relationship, seem that somehow that they're not a part of the overarching service delivery in the state of Oregon. And I have to tell you quite honestly that for me, the overarching principle is how we work together to serve a client, and not whether or not we are involved with the federal agency and how much we're getting from that federal agency. I think I transmitted that communication to the council, and that, you know, we have a situation in Oregon where we really do need to work together for the benefit of the individual that we serve, and we find ourselves sometime within a departmental situation and we're one piece of it. And it's my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that your clients also have needs from service from the other entities within the department. And if that's true, then I think we all need to kind of work together to make sure that that's where we're headed. I'm happy to hear that things are working better, and that everybody's going to try to make this thing work. That pleases me to no end, because it would be absolute chaos with every entity that has a council or has a different oversight group that's responsible came to this body and said, you know, oops, I don't want to be a part of that either. Mm-hmm. So just wanted to put that out there so that we're all on the same page.
Well, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'd like to say that I, too, am very pleased that things seem to be moving forward in a positive direction. And I don't think Director Thorne would have appointed me to this position had she not thought so. And I can assure you that I wouldn't have taken this position if I didn't think that things were headed in that direction. And I firmly believe our federal partners are on board with trying to make this work, as is the State Rehab Council.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of us have been through this once before, and Madam Chair has been through it like a bazillion times, so she's...
Bazillion.
Yeah, bazillion, whatever the number that is. It's a big number. But I am still a little confused at times about what you actually do by reading this report. You've got a $73 million budget with a huge federal match of 4-1. The question that arises in my mind is one, are we jeopardizing that federal match for you? And if we do, what would that mean if we didn't have general funds to leverage the 4-1 match? I don't see any discussion of that here. When I look back, most of the money goes to getting people into work and giving them what you call support services. I'm not sure what those support services are. I'm not sure, you know, what kind of training you're putting people through and what kind of jobs they're getting afterwards. The $9 average doesn't tell me enough. It's just that I'd like to have a little more detail to get a better feeling for what you're doing. I'm not sure I made that clear earlier. I'm trying to make it clear now. I'd like to see kind of a breakout of what kind of jobs are going to be, how much money they're making those jobs, just churning them into low-end jobs with minimum wages, which they stand for a year or two, is obviously not where you want to go and probably aren't going, but I would like to have a little more information there. And I'd be especially concerned about what would happen if you lost any of your general funds.
We'll be happy to get that to you.
It might be helpful for members of the committee who don't know that, unlike most of the agencies within the Department of Human Services, this one is funding stream is through education and not through Health and Human Services, which I had just so you know. So it is more educational in its thrust. Its objective is through education and voc rehab, and that's why the partnering with the Workforce Investment Act becomes critical in its relationship with the Employment Department. But also, I think recognizing as we look at individuals who come to even their service, it is the recognition that they have other overarching needs as well. You know, you can't anymore take a person and think they fit in a nice little peg, because there's other pieces to the human dynamics, and so that gets us into some of the other human services issues. Thank you very much for a very good presentation, and if there's no further questions, and thank you, Representative Donna Nelson, for joining us here on the podium, and we will adjourn, and we will see you tomorrow. And Rosie really thanks you today.